The UVA Lifetime Learning Program in Alumni and Parent Engagement presents this recording of the 2014 Reunion Seminar, Renovating the Rotunda, with Jody Lohendro, UVA's Historic Preservation Architect.
Thank you. Welcome back to class. It feels strange for all of us to be here, but even stranger for me to be up at this end. Let me get my technology straightened out. It's hard to believe that after a devastating fire in 1895 and a complete interior gutting in 1976, the Rotunda would still today have secrets from Thomas Jefferson to share. Yet within the last year, as research for the remaining renovations was being conducted, a consulting architect working in the Lower East Oval Room had the novel idea to look up in the oven door exposed in 1976. And found himself in a conversation with Mr. Jefferson. Through careful and methodical research that is ongoing, we are gradually re-exposing a sophisticated early 19th century chemical hearth, a niche with five furnace apertures used for conducting experiments by Dr. Emmett, first professor of natural history in the chemistry classroom that occupied this room when the Rotunda first opened in 1827. Welcome back, alumni. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you the Rotunda Renovations Project. The planning for what I'm presenting this morning started nearly 9 years ago. Construction of the Phase 1 roof replacement completed last summer began 2 years ago, and it will be another 2.5 years before the remaining renovations are completed. Though I'm going to start with an overview of the Rotunda's eventful past, then briefly run through the completed roof replacement work. Lastly, I'll focus on the planning and scope of work for the Rotunda's remaining renovations, the construction of which started in earnest just 2 weeks ago. This drawing graphically illustrates the complicated construction history that is today's Rotunda. After one appalling addition, one catastrophic fire, one heavy-handed exterior renovation, and two so-called restorations that gutted the building. In this section through the building, the red is what is left of Jefferson's original rotunda. It's the exterior brick wall shell of the drum. The yellow is the Stanford White work done after the fire. Completed in 1897, includes the dome, all the interiors, and then the porticos. Then Blue and Justice in 1976 gutted the building again, and in blue replaced all the interiors and the roof steps on the dome. In 1979, Stanislaw Mikulski replaced the steps and the terraces for the wings of the rotunda. Knowledge today of the 1827 rotunda constructed by Jefferson is sparse and incomplete. Documentation mostly relies upon a handful of extant planning drawings made by Jefferson and his workmen without knowing what was actually built, some 19th century photographs of the exterior and dome room, and contemporary etchings. What is clear, though, is that unlike the rest of the academical village, today's rotunda is very different from the original. This series shows the kind of changes that have happened. Down here at the bottom, the lawn, the two south wings facing the lawn, and the dome, and the rotunda itself, the drum and dome, that is Jefferson's original building. After the fire of 1895, the north portico was installed by McKim Mead White, as well as the north wings, and the colonnades connecting the north to the south wings. The courtyard gardens were also constructed by McKim Mead White in 1897, and the North Terrace. and then subsequent changes after that. The rotunda was originally constructed from 1822 to 1827, 1 year after Jefferson's death. The concept of a prominent building at the head of the lawn was initially recommended by Latrobe, but it was Jefferson's genius to adapt a half-size Roman pantheon to the materials, setting, and programmatic needs of a university. When placed into service, the rotunda's dome room, which is on the right, was the university's library. On the first floor, the center floor, a museum of natural history and a room for various school uses. And the chemistry classrooms on the left were in the basement oval rooms. The repair of deteriorating building elements began even before final completion of Jefferson's building. Fireplaces smoked and both the roof and skylight leaked badly, damaging books and inconveniencing students. Later 19th century photos, like this one, show the absence of steps on the roof, no doubt removed because of deterioration, and the addition of a series of cupolas constructed over the oculus to stop the leaking skylight. Despite the inconveniences, university enrollment grew rapidly in the mid-19th century, from 128 students in 1842 to 645 in 1857. In 1850, university buildings were only able to accommodate a student population of 200. In response to this growth, a large wing designed by Robert Mills was added to the rotunda's rear north elevation. Universally disliked then and now, the four-story annex was completed in 1854 and housed many classrooms, laboratories, storage rooms, and a large auditorium. It was in the annex that the devastating fire that gutted the rotunda began early on Sunday morning, October 27, 1895. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, all that was left of the annex and rotunda was a brick shell, with all attached wood trim burned off. Remnants of the damaged Carrara marble Corinthian capitals exist today in the Bailey courtyard. This shows the same capital before and after recent cleaning, which I'll just come back to later. 2 months after the fire, the university hired the New York firm of McKim, Mead, and White, at that time the preeminent architectural firm in the United States, to guide the rotunda's reconstruction. Though described as a restoration by the firm's principal in charge, Stanford White, the reconstructed rotunda was very different from Jefferson's original design. The upper two floors were now combined into one soaring library space with three levels of perimeter galleries, the lower two filled with bookcases. Other significant changes, some required by the BOV, include the addition of a north portico on what was formerly the rotunda's rear elevation, north side wings connected by colonnades to the original south wings, a terrace-level walkway above the wings connecting the porticos, and a Guastavino-tiled dome with copper roofing and altered step configuration. And you can see it here during most of the 20th century, it had patinaed green being exposed copper. Also at the BOV's direction, to replace the annex spaces, McKim, Mead, and White created three new buildings enclosing the lawn's south end: Cabell, Rouse, and Cock Halls. In 1938, nearly 40 years after the post-fire reconstruction, a major project at the porticos and terraces replaced McKim, Mead, and White's concrete steps, floorings, and railings with marble elements. At the same time, the transfer of books to the new Alderman Library removed the primary purpose of the rotunda. Immediately after the move, the first of many university committees began looking for appropriate new uses for the dome room. This one, a garden show. Against this background of disuse and gradual deterioration, a campaign began in 1955 to, quote, correct the alterations made by Stanford White, and restore the rotunda interior to Jefferson's design, end quote. Ultimately, this resulted in the second reconstruction of the rotunda from 1973 to 1976. The focus of this project was two-pronged: to replace the McKim Mead & White interior with an evocation of the original Jefferson interior, and to replace the skylight, dome roofing, and steps with something closer to Jefferson's design. In both cases, educated guesses took the place of precise documentation to recreate details of the original designs. It's been nearly 40 years since the major work of the 1970s. Over the past 20, our significant deficiencies began reappearing in facility inspection reports that are prepared every few years. The turn-coated sheet steel roofing installed in 1976 began showing signs of rusting in the mid-1990s. Starting around 2000, a springtime ritual began to seal rusted holes with caulking and paint the entire roof to hide rust stains just before final exercises. Other reported deficiencies include water infiltration in mechanical spaces, rusting equipment, spalling concrete on the underside of portico steps, an elevator that frequently breaks down, cracking of the portico columns marble bases, and high levels of humidity causing mold growth in the dome room. It was clear that the rotunda's problems required more than the cyclical maintenance it was receiving. Knowing that a major intervention was imminent, the university retained the firm of John G. Waite Associates Architects in 2005 to perform a historic structure report for the rotunda. This report was completed 2 years later in 2007. In addition to the problems noted earlier, the rotunda's HSR research identified erosion of the portico capitals, operational problems of the mechanical equipment due to inaccessibility, brick and mortar damage resulting from effervescing salts, and accelerated wear and tear in the dome room because of inadequate catering storage, to name just a few. The HSR recommendations laid out a roadmap for the university, which allowed planning to begin in earnest for implementing a capital project to renovate the rotunda. Repair and improvement recommendations were prioritized and construction costs projected. The total price tag of nearly $51 million suggested a multi-year effort. Yet, as noted in the HSR, active deterioration of historic features was ongoing due to the roof leakage. At this time, it was decided to single out the roof replacement and exterior repairs portion of the project to be an early phase of work. Initial funding was identified, and I should point out that that first phase is number one up here. All the remaining phases have been included in the second phase, which is the phase that's just started. The first phase, $7.1 million. Initial funding was identified and architectural planning began in 2010. During the year-long planning and research, numerous probes were made to confirm construction details and investigate the condition of subsurface materials. Construction of the roof and exterior repairs phase of work began the day after final exercises 2012, nearly over two years ago. While contractually construction was not required to be completed until last summer, we accelerated portions of the work to allow removal of the scaffolding in time for last year's final exercises. The budget for this first phase of work was $7.2 million. Its scope divided into three major components: roof replacement, exterior brick and window repairs, and ornamental sheet metal repairs. I'm going to quickly run through about 20 slides that's going to take you through this first phase of work, and I'm going to just describe what I see with you here and no notes. This is the setup for the project: scaffolding, creating a temporary roof covering system so that as you're replacing the roof and a storm comes up, you need to protect the building inside. I should note that the building stayed open during this project, so there were still tourists and activities going on inside. The scaffolding was set up so that major pedestrian routes could still occur around and under the scaffolding. The first step was to remove the lower two steps of the dome. These steps here were constructed in 1976, as shown in this photo done in 1976. We had to do this because during the when we did the probes, we found that one of the tension rings at the bottom of the dome had rusted badly and rusted to the point where it was in threat of failing. So we exposed it, treated it, removed the spalling, repaired it, and then recoated it, and then had to rebuild those bottom two steps. Next came the sheathing and furring for the support of the later roofing. Unlike the roof that was put in 1976, the roof we put on has a ventilation system behind it. The 76 roof, we believe, rusted almost starting immediately from the condensation coming up through the building and condensing on the underside of the metal and sitting there and rusting from the inside out. The ventilation system keeps that from happening. And then the first pieces of copper going on, there are 4,000 pieces, individual pieces, over 4,000, I'm sorry, yes, over 4,000 individual pieces of copper on this roof. Each one of them individually made for its place because of the geometry of it. That was done by, in the shop, cutting the pieces of copper to their rough sizes, and then in the field, using a brake machine to crimp, and then they would do some additional cutting to get it to fit to where it needed to go. The final roof, and then a part of this project too was to replace the Oculus skylight. The skylight was put in 1976 also. It was an anodized aluminum commercial grade skylight. We put in something appropriate for the period based upon a Latrobe skylight at Davidge Hall in Baltimore. We also, as part of this project, repaired the brickwork on the drum, Jefferson's drum, of the building. The brickwork had been badly damaged by efflorescing salts created by the leaking roof and also by erosion over time. This is the masons repointing the brick walls. Not all the brick walls got repointed. This is the attic level between the intermediary and upper cornice, and this level was completely done by McKim, Mead & White and used a Portland cement that we wanted to replace. And we use all lime mortars, traditional mortars. Oops. Windows were also taken out, temporary windows put back, and these were taken off-site, repaired, reglazed, or glazing compound replaced, painted, and brought back in and reinstalled. What most people think is wood ornament painted white on the exterior of the building is actually sheet copper pressed to ornamental shapes and painted white. Part of the BOV's charge to McKim, Mead & White was to create a fireproof building. Thus, there is no wood on the exterior of it. But this pressed metal, the architraves around the windows, the pedimented hoods above the main floor windows, and the cornice, it had been painted many, many times. We experimented with different ways of getting the paint off. And this shows you the upper level cornice and a photo of inside, how it was actually created with these wrought iron straps or braces that are built into the wall, and then the copper ornament hung from those. This is the intermediate cornice, the lower down, and here we opened it up and found far more damage than what we had expected. It was also the built-in gutter, and what we discovered is that these cast iron armatures that are every 30 inches or so were bolted into the brick wall And they're bolted into wood blocks that are put into the brick wall. Then when the bolt goes in, they expand and they hold it there by tension. The wood blocks had rotted out from the leakage from the roof. And we had found up to 1.5 inches separation of these armatures starting to lean out away from the building. We could not do this work in time for graduation and get the scaffolding down. So this piece of work has been deferred until this next upcoming phase of construction. The pedimented hoods we detached from the building to improve their anchorage, but also that allowed us to take them off-site to a company in Manassas that stripped them completely of paint and then did major repairs. This is a photo before and after repairing the corner of this Simon Reversa molding. And then primed and then brought back to the site and reinstalled. This shows you an architrave, around the window. The before, when apparently somewhere in the mid-50s, workmen took off the paint and they did it with the 5-in-1 tool by banging on the copper and popping the paint off, and it left some severe damage. We're able to repair that in the shop, as you see, and it makes for a much better appearance on the project. We had gotten things ready just before final exercises over a year ago for painting, and then the weather did not cooperate, so we had a final exercise with a copper roof. And as you know, it has stayed copper. The weather for putting on this very sophisticated, high-performance epoxy paint system on the copper and the conditions of doing it on an exposed roof give you very little tolerance of getting the right set of circumstances to happen, and we just weren't able to do it before graduation or at the end of the summer. So this also has been deferred till the next construction project. It will be painted white. That's the BOV's decision. Well before the roof replacement phase was completed, architectural planning of the remaining renovation work was well underway, having started 1.5 years ago. 2 months ago, final working drawings and specs were first received and distributed for subcontractor bidding. Construction began nearly 2 weeks ago, the day after final exercises, and will take more than 2 years to complete. Like the roof replacement work, every effort will be made to have scaffolding and construction fencing removed prior to final exercises in 2016. The construction management firm, Whiting Turner, out of Richmond, has been working on the project for over 1 year, preparing it for construction. So what is the scope for the remaining $43 million worth of work? In general, it covers the recommendations of the HSR left over after the first phase of roof replacement and exterior repairs. They can be summarized as follows. Finishing the exterior repairs, this is mostly on the wings of the building and also the sheet metal cornices that I described earlier. It's been deferred to this phase. Replace the elevator, replace the building systems, and I'll talk much more about, well, all of these. Increase the usage of the building is one of the prime objectives of this work, and then improve the landscaping. While the phase one work addressed the cylindrical drum of Jefferson's Rotunda, the remaining exterior repairs tackle 3 main features: porticos, the 4 wings, and ornamental sheet metal cornices. The north portico will undergo extensive repairs to its severely deteriorated cast concrete structure. Marble steps and flooring at both porticos will be cleaned and repaired. Roofing and built-in gutters will be replaced, and probes beneath the ornamental sheet metal wrapping the beams revealed rusting of the support steel, which will be fully exposed and replaced. The ornamental sheet metal will be paint stripped, repaired, and reinstalled. And lastly, and of special interest for most of us, the column capitals will be replaced. The black netting that has been in place for the past 3.5 years has been protecting pedestrians from falling fragments of the deteriorating capitals. An extensive study by conservationists concluded that the Georgia marble used in 1897 and the 1897 reconstruction cannot be preserved and repaired, but must be replaced. The four wings of the rotunda require exterior repairs and cleaning of brickwork, marble balustrades, windows, and colonnade ceilings and columns. The terraces above the wings will have their drainage systems corrected and then waterproofed. Recently, we've done probes at the portico roof and terrace balustrade to verify hidden construction details and tested several products for cleaning the terrace marble. Deferred from the first phase of work, the ornamental sheet metal cornices on the drum will be stripped of multiple paint layers, repaired, repainted, and structurally reattached. The currently inconvenient and unreliable elevator will be replaced with a slightly larger unit. Access at every floor will also be reconfigured to provide direct, unattended use by everyone from public spaces. Presently, the elevator, to get to it on the ground level, you have to go out into the cryptoporticus, have a guide bring a key, and let you in the door to get you into the elevator and escort you up in the elevator. And then on the main floor, it, of course, exits into the BOV room. So what's being done is that instead of exiting into the BOV room or going out to the cryptoporticus, every floor level will have an entrance from the main horseshoe center hallway, so that you'll have access to the elevator from all floors from a public space, and you won't need to have a guide assist you. The mechanical, electrical, lighting, plumbing, fire detection, sprinkler, data, security, and audiovisual systems are outdated, inadequate, or non-existent. Building systems were shoehorned into spaces in 1976, resulting in compromised maintenance and serviceability because of inaccessibility and non-code-complying clearances. The confined spaces resulted in a 1976 HVAC system that is rudimentary, providing the same temperature and volume of conditioned air to all spaces, regardless of individual room conditions. The results are uncomfortable rooms, mildew growth in poorly conditioned spaces, and wasted energy. A number of options to expand mechanical space were thoroughly studied, settling on an approach that balances historic preservation and enhanced building usage. A new underground mechanical and service vault will be constructed in the east courtyard, completely hidden from view. An underground tunnel, which is here, will connect this addition to a service elevator and stair here, next to the in the catering parking lot east of the building. The underground tunnel will also connect with the building's existing elevator, which is here, which will be extended to the new sub-basement floor. This portion of the work, by far the most expensive, is the most expensive, with a project budget of nearly $24 million. This is a rendering of the new elevator in the catering parking area and the service stair going around it. It'll just go from this level to that subterranean tunnel, which then, of course, leads to the underground mechanical vault. One central guiding principle behind these renovations has been the directive to improve the university's community's access to and use of the rotunda. Toward that end, some of the enhancements that will be implemented include change the fixed glass panels at the south portico entry into operable glass doors and an entrance, increase the classroom usage and quiet study spaces for students. Actually, both of these directives have been implemented on a trial basis starting about a year ago. The lower level west oval room has been used as a classroom for 3 days a week, Monday through Wednesday, over the last academic year. And the glass doors on the south portico now operate so that the architecture, as it tells you to enter the building here, you can actually enter it there instead of going to the basement. Access and use of the lower level gallery in the dome room. This gallery here has never been, since the 76 reconstruction, has never been accessible by the public. We are going to be putting in a stair to access it, and it'll be open for students or public use for study. Enlarge and remodel restrooms, improve the visitor center and museum, replace the metal ceiling panels in the dome room with acoustical plaster, provide a shading device at the dome room oculus to allow daytime projection, and increase storage and preparation space for catering and other services supporting large events. In 1976, this is the only room space they allowed for catering in the building. There are almost 250 catered events a year in the rotunda. And what they have to do is set up plating positions in the crypto porticus next to the trash cans for the lower levels, or in the dome room, they keep their supplies in two of the niches on the side of the dome room, which of course takes up space and also creates damage to the building as it's being moved around. Lastly, landscapes at the two courtyards and North Terrace will be renovated utilizing information from a recently completed cultural landscape report. Schematic designs were approved by the BOV just yesterday. This is a schematic design for the North Terrace, this part of the building, showing some low trees and surrounding shrubs to create smaller outdoor rooms. And then for the courtyards, left, west and east, this is the west and east, plan to have fountains in them and sitting areas for the public. Extensive planning and preparations begun a year and a half ago were finally placed into action with the start of construction 2 weeks ago after final exercises. Construction fencing and wayfinding signage have been installed. The Galt statue of Jefferson was just moved last week. And as you can see, this is us. This is it being crated up inside the rotunda, moved out in the box, lowered in the crane, and is now over in the Special Collections Library, in a niche there. I have to show this. An incredible coincidence happened. We were a little bit more careful than they were in 1976 when they moved the statue. They do have a bale of hay under it. But the day that we were moving it, this gentleman, Don Payne, happened to be on site getting fixtures and things that we were donating to Habitat from the site. And he came into the building, he looked up the ceiling, the acoustical panel ceiling, and said, I installed those panels. James Zimmer, who works with us, asked him, well, did you by chance, were you here when they moved the statue? And he said, yeah, I did. And James had on his phone this picture, and he showed him this picture. He said, well, that's me. And he happened to show up the day we were moving the statue again. So we got a picture of him. To protect the Jeffersonian chemical hearth during demolition and underpinning, conservators consolidated loose original plaster and installed protective covers. We are also installing a very sophisticated building monitoring system to track any unexpected movements during the upcoming underpinning and excavating operations. Four computer scanners continuously take readings from nearly 130 prismatic targets placed on the rotunda and Pavilion 2. Emergency protocols will soon be in place that will respond to any unexpected movement within the buildings. The decision to construct a subterranean mechanical room in the East Courtyard prompted a couple of preparatory actions this past winter and spring, one of which was the removal of magnolias in both courtyards, 20th century trees that were near or past their life expectancy. The other was a campaign of archaeological research that had to be completed prior to starting construction. While archaeology is required for any excavation within the academical village, here it was especially important because of mid-19th century documentation that locates a cistern in each of what later became the courtyards. This is a, underneath the some other drawings on top, is the Galt mid-1850s map of infrastructure at the university. I'm sorry, not Galt. Steve. not Galt. His name will come to me. Anyway, he was in charge of the university's buildings and grounds at the time. He drew a map, and you can see these impressions here. Those are indications for cisterns. So we expected to find a cistern in the east courtyard. Rivanna Archaeological Services began its survey last fall and eventually found under the modern fountain a cistern dating to the early 1850s. Dating the cistern has been assisted by inscriptions left by workmen in the mortar parging lining the brick interior, one of whom is known to the archaeologists from prior research. The cistern appears to be one of several that university BOV records report to have been constructed in 1851 to serve chemistry classrooms in the soon-to-be-constructed annex. Archaeological fieldwork has been completed and the features have been thoroughly recorded. And in the case of some of the inscriptions, we have cut them out, boxed them, and have stored them off-site, and they'll be part of the museum. As part of its design phase services, our construction management firm identified procurement and fabrication of the portico's marble capitals as a long lead item that required it to begin last fall. After identifying and interviewing a number of qualified stone subcontractors, the university selected Rugo Stone in Northern Virginia, teamed with Pedrini Stone Carvers in Carrara, Italy. Following extensive research, Carrara marble was selected for the new capitals, matching that used by Jefferson for the originals. In preparation for matching marble colors and original carving details, the university accumulated all of the scattered fragments of the Jeffersonian capitals and had conservationists clean the large remnants at the Bailey. Pedrini then spent 2 days at the university taking computer scans of all the remnants, which together make up about 80% of the original capitals. The remaining 20% must be interpolated from pre-fire photographs. A subcommittee of the design team has made 2 trips to Carrara, taking a Virginia flag with them, to inspect quarter section mock-ups. Even with the extensive documentation, there's a remarkable amount of minute refinements that are required to achieve accurate replications of Jefferson's capitals. The upper section with the undocumented features was modeled in clay to allow adjustments during the team's site visit. The CNC automated machine, a 6-axis robotic arm with a diamond carving bit, takes a month to remove the bulk marble from one capital. It then takes another month for a sculptor to complete the carving by hand. While the carvers are at work, the project team is busily planning the unloading, conveyance, lifting, and placement of all 16 capitals, each one weighing 9,000 pounds. I hope I've been able to convey something of the paradox that is the rotunda. This pile of bricks, wood, steel, and copper that generations of Virginians have reformed into an iconic symbol believed to have been frozen in Jefferson's time has actually experienced tragedy, abuse, and frequent change, sometimes catastrophic. Change is not inherently bad, and in fact, for historic buildings such as the Rotunda that continues to serve the university since its 1827 construction, it is absolutely necessary. Renovations currently underway preserve this World Heritage Site for generations to come while accommodating the infrastructure and program support changes that will keep the Rotunda a vital participant in Mr. Jefferson's university. Thank you. I have to show you this. They had a strange custom here until the early 1970s of burning a cake of the rotunda with the annex. And that, in fact, is Dr. Shannon, President Shannon's wife in the checkered suit there. This photo was taken about 1964. Questions?
We've got some time for questions.
Yes. The original roof was a tin-coated metal, iron sheet that Jefferson used, similar to the kind of shingles that you'll see on the pavilions. It was his metal shingle system. It was not painted, but it was tin, so it oxidized somewhat off-white. And it was that way until the later 19th century, when it was starting to leak, and they covered it with tar at one point. They painted it. They did tried most anything to keep water from getting in.
Is there a current debate between leaving it copper and painting it white?
Oh yes, there was. I don't know if it's still up. There's a website that had a survey going of who wanted it copper, who wanted it white, and what I tell people is that I'm a low-level functionary doing what I'm told, and the BOV told me to paint it.
And partly it is painted white.
It's the plant. The BOV says paint it white. Yes. Didn't use that in the present billing. Well, no. The reason was that we knew we were going to be painting it. I mean, the expectation was always that we were going to paint it, and the lead coat of copper would have given it a different kind of hue. Yes, sir.
Does it have a coating or something down? Because it looks very dark. It doesn't look like copper.
It's oxidized, yes. So it's in the process of wanting to turn to green. It would be, in the environment we have nowadays, it would be 10 years before it turned green, because you just don't have the kind of car fume pollution you used to have. But it eventually would turn green. But so it is part of the... Part of the painting it, and one of the real difficulties of painting a roof like that is that you've got to take it down to bare metal again. So you've got to scrub it all down to bare copper before you can put the primer on. And the primer has to go on in a certain range of temperature. It cannot be, we cannot get any moisture on it during the period that it sets up. And then you have to put the second coat on within a certain time frame, and it cannot get any water on it while it sets up. It's a very, and it has to be done within certain temperature range and humidity ranges too. Yeah. No, not a hard at all. Any other questions? Yes. No, you know, I heard when I, when was the earthquake? That was the Louisa earthquake. That was several years ago. Yeah, I heard some rumors that they'd seen some open cracks, some more cracking inside, but it's never been verified, I don't think. Yes? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. I mean, we explored not having one and continuing to have come down the cryptoporticus and go through the rotunda to get to the elevator. But it's from the people working there and using the building, it's very disruptive, and doing the programming for the upcoming work, it was determined that that was just not an acceptable way of doing it. They also need more space. And part of the underground vault in that east courtyard next to that tunnel is an additional catering space. So they'll be able to bring in their food and trays, plug them in, keep them warm in that underground space, and then take them up through the elevator to the dome room and plate them up in the dome room. So it just made the most sense to do it that way. And that was, we had a programming phase, interviewed all the occupants of the rotunda, as well as you can imagine, at the university, there are lots of stakeholders and you get lots of opinions. And we heard them all, and we absorbed them all, and this was the decision. So Board of Visitors, the State Department of Historic Resources does review the project and does pass on it, and they have approved the project. And they act as the agent for the World Heritage Sites, ICOMOS, and for the federal Department of Parks. You know what I'm trying to say. Thank you. But that our state Department of Historic Resources has an agreement with both of those agencies to act as their intermediary. Yes, sir. The new capitals, the Jefferson's Carrera capitals on Pavilion 2, on Pavilion 5 and 8, they're as crisp as the day they were carved today. You go to the one that's in the Bailey Museum, the front terrace of the Bailey Museum, the original rotunda capital, the remnant that still exists, it's as crisp as the day it was carved. So at least as 200 years that we, I won't be worrying about it. Yes. Olin Landscape is the landscape architect for the project. And we wanted the directive to them from the University Architect's Office. I talk like I do all this. I don't. In fact, I want to introduce Steve Ratliff. He is the Construction Administration CAM on the project manager, and he handles the day-to-day construction operations of the project. So I'd never hear the end of it. I didn't. We have, and besides Steve, we have someone who works with me, James Zimmer. He is an assistant project manager on this project. Also, he's an alum. Brian Hogg is the senior preservation planner in the University Architect's Office. That is the contact on the project team, and he's an alum also. So you all are well represented. I forgot where I was going with your question. So the University Architect's Office gave them instruction. They wanted, they went to them, and we asked them for their professional advice, and they spent time here. They looked at the spaces. They got input from the University Architect's Office about how they were being used or not used or inadequately used. Their feeling about the North Terrace was that it's an open, sun-baked stretch of paving that no one uses. And they wanted to be able to create some outdoor rooms where one would feel comfortable going there and sitting and being near the rotunda. And the courtyards were considered to be an even more intimate area. In fact, they devised the east courtyard. They think of that as being a morning space because it is on the eastern side and it catches the morning sun. So they have more planting there, and it's more of an intimate space where people can go with a book or meet somebody before class. And then the western courtyard is more open because they see that as being used in the evenings by small groups, cocktail parties or small events. So that's how they approach the design. Yes, sir.
Are there any major renovation plans or not regarding the pavilions or?
We have within the last few years we've done extensive rehabilitations of Pavilion 9, Pavilion 2, and Pavilion 10. What happens is that we do historic structure reports ahead of time. That gives us a sense of the kind of condition they're in. When Murray Howard was here, 25, 30 years ago, he had done rehabilitation of them too, but they're getting on, and systems are the first thing to be outdated in any of these buildings. And so we keep a running list of what needs to be done in the pavilion, and then when one becomes available, it has to become available when a tenant, occupant, locates out of it, and it become, and we can, we get ahead of it. We say, look, can we have this for a year after the occupant is out? And if we can get it for a year and take it offline for that long, then we do the planning for major intervention of systems and repairs, and we get in and do that work. So we spent, you know, on Pavilion 10, I would think, is close to $3 million on that work, both the exterior and the interior. Pavilion 9 was about $2 million and 2 also. We also have to have the money. The Rotunda is siphoning off most of our money right now. So there, Pavilion 8 would be the next one in line to have work done, significant work done to it. But we'll have to get the Rotunda paid for it first. Yes, sir? Yes, it does. That is Jefferson's original color. we had 3 different paint analysts do the exterior paint research on that building. We know from the period that, and you could look at the cross section of 35 different paint layers and see it go from a stone color, a little bit less stone, a little bit beige, a little bit lighter, and then in the 20th century it just becomes white. And we call it refrigerator white, but that's what it gets painted every year because we have a lot of it. but it's just the easiest thing to do, but it's not historically accurate. Jefferson's, these buildings are modeled on ancient buildings, Roman, Greek buildings, and they were constructed out of stone. And when Jefferson built these, what he had is wood. He adapted it to our construction types and our climate and availability of materials, and he created these elements out of wood, but he wanted them to still look like they were stone. So they had a stone color to them. And we recently found a reference from Breckenridge, Brockenbro, who was the head of the construction of the university, to Jefferson saying, well, we'll paint the elements of the stone color. And it's documented too. So now we did this several years ago. We chose Pavilion 10 because it was on the end, kind of separated from the others, and we wanted to have a conversation. We just wanted to start that conversation of what everyone goes to the lawn and stands on the lawn, they think they're looking at Jefferson's lawn. They're not. The lawn has changed quite a bit since Jefferson's time. We just don't understand, or it's not apparent to us. And we wanted to let people see what the actual lawn was like during Jefferson period. And the color is one thing, also the flat roofs on the student rooms next to it. We have restored the flat roof over the student rooms between Pavilion 7 and 9. The gabled slate roofs that are over the student rooms, they were put in the late 1830s because Jefferson's roofs leaked like sieves. And they put that gable roof over it. But the experience, if you can while you're here, get up on that terrace between 7 and 9 and experience the university that way, being able to see the garden and the lawn at the same time instead of just being able to see the lawn and having a gable roof next to you on the other side. That conversation is still going on. Mr. Sandridge put a moratorium on using any more of it until this had sort of played out, and we had this conversation, and we let the community decide.
And Monticello, West Lawn, at least it was still at the columns.
Yes, and that's what they found there, that it was an integral colored stucco that is a stone color. Yes, ma'am. Yes, it was. Jefferson's clock was, I believe, a little bit larger dial than the one that McKinney and White put in. But yes, it was there from the very beginning. Jefferson, in fact, they paid an awful lot for it. They used a Boston clockmaker to make it, and they paid an exorbitant amount for it. And it was a weight-driven mechanism, and the weights went down. You know, the elevator is in one of the open cells at the joint of the dome with the porticos and in that in between place. And the elevator is in one of those open cells that was there. The other cell went all the way up and down three stories, and that's where the weights were. Yes. When do we expect it to be finished? It contractually is to be finished July of 2016. But like the roof project was the same way. It was going to be finished in the middle of the summer contractually, but we are doing everything we can with our contractor to get the scaffolding and the fencing down before graduation of 2016. And if the weather holds and if we don't run into any surprises, we'll be able to do that. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you again. And
oh, you're fine. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
How did I do time-wise?